Hey, China, baby, you played too rough. You slapped 34 on and all that ain't love. I gave you till Tuesday to say you're sorry, but guess what, sweetie, that ship sailed early. Don't cry on the trading floor. It's just diplomacy, but hardcore. We talked to some countries, not all. Guess which empire won't get a call. We had a terror fever, turn it up some more. 50 on 34, now we're at a normal floor. Don't need no trade talks, we just do the math. Taking my sports, baby, feel my wrath. We got that terror fever, shaking every port. Seeking markets like it's a contact sport. Raise it high, spin that tax roulette. If you retaliate, I'll double the bet. Next, oh, don't look shocked. 10% for friendship, consider it doc. We're spreading love like a steel-toed boot. Global harmony in a tailored suit. Every deficit's a dagger to my pride, so I'll fix it with some duties on the side. Who needs allies when you've got the vibe? Just me, my posts, and my 4D tribe. Yeah, terror fever, truth posted loud. Dancing through the trade war, feeling proud. Markets crash, that's just the sound of greatness echoing around. And under 4%, maybe that's how we roll. Every import tax like rock and roll. So in the world tonight.
This isn't a tantrum. It's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports for your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm working harder.
We've got tariff favorism with the moon. Trade talks canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. 104%, baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit that beat and tax the rhyme. Hit that beat and tax the rhyme.
This isn't a tantrum, it's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports from your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm winning harder.
We got the terror fever rising with the moon. Trade talks canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. 104%, baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit that beat and tax the rhyme. And tax the rhyme.
Yeah. Ja.
Je komt voor het recht. Zijn er niet, hè?
We staan nu in de hal.
U mag buiten blijven tenzij u één voor één naar het toilet gaat. Het vriendelijke verzoek om direct bij te trekken. Er is al iemand op het toilet, dus u mag naar buiten.
Is de rechtbank vandaag ook aanwezig?
Zij gesloten.
Dank u. Dat wou ik even weten. Het recht is er vandaag niet.
Het recht is gesloten.
Ik ben niet aan het filmen.
U mag naar buiten.
Ik ben niet aan het filmen.
Maar u mag naar buiten, u mag niet naar binnen.
Dat is een huishoudelijke mededeling. Het recht is er niet vandaag.
Ah, het recht is er niet.
De rechtbank ook niet.
Oh, het recht is er wel langer.
Ja, dat is voor mij.
Het papiertje nog wat doen. Dat is dat van de vijand.
We gaan nu met PostNL.
Nou, dat concludeert de procedure hier, geloof ik. Wij mogen met de bus. Alle mensen die hier zijn. Nou, het was een leerzaam bezoekje. Ze hebben er wat moois van gemaakt van de nieuwe gevangenis. Dus ja, de dekmantel voor de grote Schipholbrand waarbij 11 mensen om het leven kwamen. En onlangs nog papa Sacco ook overleden is, een van de overlevenden. En daarover kun je van alles vinden bij Stichting Migrant to Migrant. En ja, daar staan allemaal dingen te gebeuren dit jaar. Herdenkingstekens. bijeenkomsten. Dus ja, hou het in de gaten, lieve luisteraar. Voor nu is het wel weer klaar. En nou ja, binnenkort gaan we nog wel weer wat meer uitzenden. Maar ik weet nog niet precies wanneer. Misschien vandaag nog zelfs. Bij Ruigoord is nog Groenoord aan de gang. Ja, de inclusief 4 mei heb ik niet kunnen vinden in de buurt. Er wordt zo hard achteruit gekeken dat niemand enig idee heeft wat er aan de hand is op dit moment. Dus ik ga wat anders doen. En, maar iets anders is ook iets anders. Dus blijf lekker luisteren naar Radio Pattenpoel. Want er komt altijd meer, maar je weet nooit wanneer.
Se sirote en pleurant à la recherche des absents au soleil levant. La tête basse, on s'obstine, attendant de quel nuage viendra le signe. Bientôt quelqu'un va nous manquer, les yeux trop petits pour nous planquer. La douleur des jours de triste costume qui nous rappelle qu'on n'aime qu'à titre posthume. La joie est une révolte matée, une pluie de l'intérieur colmatée. Si le chagrin nous met à l'abri du réconfort, comme on l'a saisi, faut qu'on soit fort. Pour la vie devant soi. La vie est une tristesse à dépasser pendant longtemps par des rires d'enfants, des souvenirs d'antan. Pendant la chute, on s'accroche à des devises, passer les consolations, le silence livre, une peine aux pages closes, desquelles on se délivre, par des mots qui prennent la peine et la divisent. Vaut mieux chanter ensemble qu'y penser tout seul, à cette vie qui continue sans perdre boussole. Nous, sur l'écorce terrestre, n'avons plus qu'à aimer ceux qui restent. Prenons-nous dans les bras, pendant que le loup n'y est pas.
What Liu Xing was saying at this time was quite deliberate, and Gao Shengchan interpreted his words very correctly. His unspoken message was that although the people were afraid of the officials were also afraid of the people. If news of a possible mass protest became known, it was quite possible that local officials would want to resolve the situation before it escalated. During the preparatory stages of a protest, both sides still had room to maneuver. But after the protest broke out, the outcome was unpredictable. If the protesters were charged with beating, smashing, stealing and fighting, suppressed and thrown into jail, both the officials and the people would suffer. Even if, after the protest, a few officials lost their jobs and were replaced, it would be of no real help to anybody. But who should one inform about the possible outbreak of a mass protest, Gao Shengchan pondered. If you're too open, it'll become a public incident and the local officials will lose face. If you're not open enough, you'll be ineffective. For example, Liu Xing would just pretend that he doesn't know anything about it because it's not under his department. Gao Shengchan gloomily ate his after-dinner fruit and wondered which official would be worried about this impending incident. Of course, the township party leadership was the most directly involved. But if they hadn't been so fixated about making money in the first place, they would not have created the situation. With the prospect of great financial gains, they would not shed tears until being measured for their coffins. They would not give in. There would have to be a real mass protest before they would change their tune. But that was just what Gao Shengchun was trying to prevent in order to protect the interests of his church. He thought it over and concluded that if he was going to let the cat out of the bag, he would have to go to a higher level of government, to the county government. So then he changed the subject and casually said, "Our Wen County head Yang is very capable and has a good reputation, no?" "Little Yang is young and talented. He's only in his 30s and has a great future," said Liu Xing, who had just been waiting for Gao Shengchan to mention county head Yang. Gao Shengchan understood that Liu Xing was telling him who he should go to a young official in charge of the county's various townships and anxious about his future career. "Did you know," Liu Xing said with an upward gesture of his hands, "our mayor of Jiazhou was transferred here from Fujian? And did you know that county head Yang was selected for promotion by the mayor? And did you know that at this latest change of government, the mayor was promoted again to provincial level?" "He really is my old classmate," Gao Shengchan gratefully thought to himself. "So he's making everything clear for me. A new mayor has been promoted from outside the province, and he will certainly promote some cadre to fill up his staff. But he won't use men like Liu Xing, who were loyal to the former mayor. County head Yang is a follower of the present mayor, and as long as the present mayor is promoted and warms his seat at the provincial government, he will move Yang to work alongside him. All that the young county head Yang has to do is to make certain that nothing big happens in the county in the next couple of months, and he can be smoothly promoted to serve as a provincial level official. In other words, if a mass protest were to break out in the county, regardless of whether it were handled badly or well, county head Yang's chances of a provincial lead promotion would be ruined. So county head Yang was the ideal candidate to be informed about the possibility of such a protest. How could a young and able man like him allow his official career to be put in jeopardy by the actions of a couple of corrupt township officials? When it was clear Gao Shengcheng had completely understood what he was telling him, Liu Xing seemed to experience a pleasing sense of pride. Then he stood up and staggered over to the bathroom. Gao Shengcheng took immediate advantage of his absence to phone Li Tiejun and tell him to make an appointment as soon as possible with county head Yang. Fang Chaodi knew that Jiazhou was an important producer of Chinese medicines such as foxglove, Romania glutinosa, Discoria opposita yams, Acyranthus bidentata root, and chrysanthemums. So he had already planned to buy some supplies to cure Zhang Du's internal injuries and Miao Miao's strange sort of idiocy. He got up at 4:30, completed his qigong exercises, and went out before dawn without disturbing Old Chen's sleep. After their long drive the day before, Old Chen was extremely tired, but he didn't sleep well all the same. He got up at 6 and had breakfast in the hotel restaurant, but he had to wait until 9 before Fang Chaodi finally arrived, carrying a big backpack full of herbal medicines. At that point, Old Chen looked quite annoyed. The two of them left hurriedly and set out for the Warm Springs township. When they reached the center of the provincial city, Fang Chaodi asked a taxi driver if he knew there was a Christian church called the Grain Fallen on the Ground in Wen County. The taxi driver said it was only a short distance away and told Fang Chaodi to follow him and he would take them right to the front door free of charge. "Isn't it an underground church?" asked Old Chen. "How come everybody knows the address and there are Christian spring couplets openly displayed on the front gate?" "The Henan people have not offended anybody," said Fang Chaodi, "but everybody criticizes them. Look how generous this driver is." Gao Shengchen and Li Tiejun were in the yard preparing to leave for their meeting with county head Yang. "Our fellowship has 1,000 members in the Wen County area alone," said Li Tiejun proudly. "How could the county head dare refuse to see us?" Gao Shengchen kept reminding Li Tiejun that when they met with the county head, to leave the talking to him. He felt confident that he could persuade Yang to solve the Zhang family village land rights encroachment, so he asked Li Tiejun not to interfere. As they were thinking and talking, the four men met at the front gate. "Morning, friends," Fang Chaodi spoke up, afraid that Old Chen's Taiwanese accent might give rise to suspicion. Sorry to trouble you, but is this the Church of the Grain Fallen on the Ground? That's right, Li Tiezhen answered somewhat warily. Who are you looking for? We're looking for a woman called The Grain Does Not Die, said Fang Chaodi. Her real name is, what is it? Wei Sihong, Little Si, Ou Chen said. Do you know her? Asked Fang Chaodi. Wei Sihong, Wei Sihong. Li Tiezhen didn't want to lie, so he just repeated the name. Little Si, Little Si. She's from Beijing, offered Fang Chaodi. From Beijing. Li Tiezhen went on repeating as though he was thinking about it. From Beijing, come to Henan from Beijing. Who's in charge here? Asked Fang Chaodi impatiently. God is in charge here, said Li Tiezhen. Don't talk nonsense, said Fang Chaodi. Forget it, let's go, said Ou Chen, pulling Fang Chaodi away. Li Tiezhen turned around, closed the front gate very purposefully, and walked off with Gaosheng Chan towards the township. The shepherd has a responsibility to protect his sheep, he thought. Those two, he said to Gaosheng Chan, might be public security informers, so I didn't want to tell them anything, but I didn't lie either. Gaosheng Chan had not said a word, but he had a different opinion of Chen and Fang. He felt that Ou Chen and Little Si had a special relationship, a male-female relationship. And so, even though he knew where she was, he didn't want to help them find her. He knew that they would come back, and he felt a little uneasy about his refusal to talk to them. He had to handle things in the order of their importance, and the most important of important things he had to concentrate on now was to prevent his fellowship from being drawn into a protest. If Ou Chen had not received Jiang Du's text message, he would not have known for certain that Little Si was there, and he might have had his confidence shaken by this encounter. Now that they had located the church, he knew for certain that Little Si was there somewhere. Those two fellows were simply unwilling to tell them the truth. He told Fang Chaodi to stay there at the church and watch for Little Si to come out while he himself returned to the township centre, found an internet cafe, and tried to communicate with Mai Zibusi online. Ou Chen and Fang Chaodi didn't know that Gaosheng Chen and Li Tiezhen were fully aware that Little Si was at that very moment inside the church attending a Bible reading class. She would not leave the church that day, but would eat lunch there, and in the afternoon she would go to the internet and surf the virtual world, or perhaps use her Mai Zibusi web name to write a blog on the peasants' rights defense movement. She might even receive an answering post accusing her of being a son of a bitch who turned the truth upside down. Dinner in the village at 5 p.m., participation in the fellowship witness meeting at 6:30, and at 8 p.m., a discussion with the most enthusiastic brothers and sisters of the plans for the final meeting on the Jiang family village land rights protest. Little Si felt that her life was richly rewarding. The population of the Warm Springs Township was less than 100,000, but there were quite a few internet cafes. As Gaosheng Chan and Li Tiezhen were going into the county head's office in the county government building on Yellow River Road, Ou Chen was entering an internet cafe that had just opened for business. He was extremely excited when he found Mai Zibusi's blog and comments. Little Si was so far away and yet so close. But 4 hours passed before Ou Chen posted his first comment. At first, he thought he would play it cool, so he wrote a post saying that he was travelling with a friend in Henan and visiting Jiazhou to buy Chinese medicines. He disingenuously asked her if she was still in Beijing and said he'd like to meet up with her. He probably thought that she would respond to this by saying, what a coincidence that she was also in Jiazhou, and why didn't he meet her for dinner at the Yiwan Hotel? Fortunately, he didn't send this message. Who was he going to fool? It was too ridiculous. So he wrote a different message, apologizing for when Wen Lan had suddenly appeared and saying he hoped he could see Little Si. To such a message, however, she would probably just respond that it was no big deal, no need to apologize, never mind, see you sometime when we have the time. he still would not get to see her. Given her assumptions about his relationship with Wen Lan, she probably would not want to be alone with old Chen again. He would have to tell her the honest truth, that he'd come to Jiazhou in Wen County deliberately to see her, that he wanted to see her because he wanted to be with her. He decided it was time to declare his love. If he could do so openly, everything else could be talked through in more detail later. Some 20 years earlier, he'd fallen in love with Wen Lan, and she had hurt him badly. For many years after that, he didn't dare have any feelings for anyone else. To open his heart now to little C would certainly take a great deal of courage. Old Chen sat there blankly for 2 hours before he finally wrote a nearly 5,000-word post entitled "A Letter to Mai Zibushi from Someone Who Is Not a Stranger," in which he poured out his thoughts and feelings in fast-flowing prose. The first line of Chen's letter was, "When you open this letter, I will be at the modern Fuxi Internet Cafe on Yellow River Road in Warm Springs Township, Wen County, Jiazhou City." Next, he told her that after he'd met her at the Five Flavors restaurant in Wudaogou in the 1990s, he had always loved her. He'd never expressed himself at the time because she had so many male friends around her all the time, and then later she had an English boyfriend. Still later, because he'd been hurt so badly, he was afraid to ever try to have another serious relationship. Old Chen described how he and Wen Lan had met, become engaged, how she'd dumped him, and how, 20 years later, he ran into her by chance as a French crystal chandelier. Most importantly, he told her how very recently he had lost his heart to another woman whom he had not seen in a long time, how he had learned to get in touch with her, how he had waited for her reply, how they had met again, how he had lost contact with her again because of Miss Wen's barging in, how he had looked her up on the internet, how he had followed a possibly unreliable lead and come to Henan, and how he had put the pieces of the puzzle together and learnt that she was in Warm Springs, and that woman was Little C. Now he only hoped that she would give him a chance, would communicate with him, would give him time in Henan, in Beijing, or anywhere else to prove his love. He'd also brought along a friend who could help restore her memory. Old Chen even told Little C of his thoughts about death on the drive to Henan, that if he were to die in an accident, he hoped it would be while holding her hand and facing their last seconds of life together. Or if he were to die a natural death, he hoped that she would be sitting at his bedside watching over him. He wanted to live out his last years with her. Old Chen wanted to post the letter as a comment on Little C's blog, but it was much too long. He had to divide it into several smaller sections and post each one separately while leaving a notice that he had a blog on the Sina Network where the entire letter could be read as a whole. After Old Chen had finished pouring his heart out, he sat very calmly in front of the computer and checked every few minutes to see if there was any answer. Shortly after lunch, Little C had indeed gone online and very soon noticed Old Chen's post, after which she went to his Sina blog and read the entire letter. It made her whole body feel totally paralyzed. For the past 2 years, she had wanted so badly to find someone she could really communicate and share her feelings with, but every time she'd been disappointed. After meeting Old Chen again, she had fantasized that he was different from other men, but in the end, or so she thought, she had become another woman. As she was despairing more and more, she discovered the church fellowship. She didn't really believe in religion, but what she'd found was a large extended family. Then, when the Jiang Family Village Rights Protection Movement had come along, it made her feel useful. She never imagined that at this point, Old Chen would come into her life again to declare undying love. Little C sat blankly in front of her computer for over an hour. She knew that at another computer, someone else was also sitting there blankly. Finally, she posted an answer. I am no longer the little C that you knew. I like the present you even more, was old Chen's immediate answer. I suffer from clinical depression, she wrote. I know. I'll take care of you, he fired back. My body is decrepit beyond repair. I'm proof of your beauty. I'm not sure I want a relationship. I'll wait patiently until you decide. I'm sure I don't have time for a relationship, Dilsey wrote. I can wait as long as you want, in Henan or anywhere else, Ouchen answered. They went back and forth like this until after 5 in the afternoon, when Little C sent a last post. I have to go offline. Give me some time to think things over, then we'll talk again. Little C went to help the fellowship prepare dinner, and Ouchen closed down the computer. He decided to go to the church and look for her. What the two of them didn't know was that during the entire afternoon, many netizens were following their posts with bated breath. After they left their computers, the netizens' comments on their dialogue took over. Some said it was very moving, some said it was schmaltzy, some said it was cute, and some even said it was disgusting. Taiwanese netizens said they had to admire this romantic auntie and uncle, while mainland netizens said that no matter how you looked at it, it was amazing how they kept going. On the whole, though, these netizens reached a pretty unified verdict. Stop faffing around, Little C. Make up with old Chen and everything will be okay. At around 6, the brothers and sisters of the Warm Springs Fellowship finished their evening meal and came to the church with their hearts full of thanksgiving to wait for the witness meeting to begin. Kaohsiung Chan and Li Tiezhen had also just emerged from the county government building and decided to say a simple prayer then and there on the street to thank the Lord for his grace. That morning at the meeting with the young and able county head Yang, Kaohsiung Chan had said what needed to be said as though with the Lord's help, stating his case thoroughly and in a dignified manner. Although the county head had remained silent throughout, Kaohsiung Chan was confident that Yang had listened to him attentively. As for how the official would evaluate the pros and cons of this case and what the fate of the church might be, Kaohsiung Chan left that in God's hands. When they left the morning meeting, the head secretary had come to find them and advised them not to go too far and to be ready to be called back. This was a good sign. The two of them waited in a small restaurant near the government building. Let's say a prayer, Kaohsiung Chan said, taking Li Tiezhen's hand. County Head Yang conferred with his advisers and then called the township leader and the business's representative to an immediate meeting. The meeting lasted until after 5. Then Yang summoned Kaohsiung Chan and Li Tiezhen to his office. Yang thought like a bureaucrat, but he was also pretty smart. He knew that Kaohsiung Chan was trying to force his hand, but he also knew that for the sake of his future career, he had to back down somewhat. He informed Kaohsiung Chan and Li Tiezhen the Jiang Family Village land requisition program was definitely going forward as planned, but with the good offices of the county government, every family would receive increased compensation for their land. Furthermore, due to a revision in the amount of land required, the land occupied by the homes of the church members was no longer within the scope of the plan. In this way, the business interest group had been made to give up some of their large potential profits, and the township leaders who had failed to stop corruption had been thoroughly reprimanded. The government's credit with the people had been maintained, and an organized mass protest had been prevented. As County Head Yang formally escorted Kaohsiung Chan and Li Tiezhen to his office door, he reflected that when promoted to provincial level, he would no longer have to deal with the schemes of these church people. Kaohsiung Chan, aware that he had achieved his goal, offered up a few words of praise. Yang was a genuine mother and father to the people, he said. And Yang replied that it was the people who were his mother and father, and it was his duty as a mere public servant to serve them. In this fashion, With a mutual acknowledgement of their insincerity, they bid each other a cool goodbye. Walking back to the church, Gao Shengchan felt he had accomplished something very good. The rights of his parishioners had been restored, and a direct confrontation between the church and the government had been avoided. His only worry was in facing those of his flock who'd been so enthusiastically preparing to mount a protest, especially Little Xi. Nevertheless, Gao Shengchan never wavered as to what was important and what was not. Meanwhile, Old Chen and Fan Chaodi were sitting in the chapel among the worshippers and looking all around for Little Xi. Xi was in the kitchen, and while helping to prepare refreshments, she was just managing to calm herself after the emotional turmoil of the afternoon, when she looked out and spotted Old Chen among the faithful. Her heart immediately started to race again. She hid behind the door, not daring to enter the chapel. Just then, she heard the sound of the Canaan hymn, "What Am I?" and felt deeply moved. Gao Shengchen and Li Tiejian entered the chapel, and Gao instructed Li to ask the congregation to settle down because they had something to tell them. Then Gao Shengchen announced the new decision taken by the government on the Jiang family village land issue. This decision in favour of the brothers and sisters of their fellowship, he said, was an example of God's grace and demonstrated that God had heard everyone's prayer. Finally, he led them all in giving thanks, shouting, "Thanks be to the Lord!" Some of the faithful were moved to tears of joy. Many of them, however, were there precisely to witness such moving reactions. When they'd settled down again, Old Chen stood up and proclaimed in a loud voice, "Everybody, I have something I want to say to you." Li Tiejian tried to stop him, but Gao Shengchen indicated to Li to let him speak. Gao Shengchen knew that such events could not be prevented by force, but had to be handed over to the Lord for his disposition. "Fellow countrymen," said Old Chen, "I am on the lookout for someone. Her name is Wei Xihong, also known as Little Xi." The people stared quietly at the stranger, but did not respond. "I am a friend of hers," added Old Chen. Still, no response. "If you know where she is," Old Chen continued, "please tell me. Please let me see her because I love her very much and I can't live without her. I hope you can tell me if she is here or not." The entire fellowship of the good people of Henan looked back intently at Old Chen. Old Chen waited with rising emotion, fighting back his tears. All he received in return was a deep silence. Finally, he calmed himself down, nodded slightly to them to indicate that he would not persist. He turned and walked slowly towards the door. "Old Chen!" Little Xi burst out of the kitchen. Old Chen stopped, looked round. "Old Chen," Little Xi said calmly, "let's go back to Beijing." Epilogue. A very long night, or a warning about China's 21st century age of ascendancy. The life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Thomas Hobbes, The Leviathan. Look at the ants crawling round and round, marshalling their troops, the bees roiling in confused chaos, brewing their honey, and hordes of buzzing flies fighting over the blood. Ma Ji Yan, Autumn Thoughts on the Night Voyage. All is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's Candide. Idealism, Chinese style. Hundreds of millions of Chinese lived through an age that witnessed a storm of idealism and were baptized in that flood of idealism. Even though later on their ideals turned to nightmares and disillusionment, and an entire generation of people lost their ideals, still they didn't abandon idealism. Tang Chaodi and Little C had grown up in that turbulent era. They themselves were probably not even aware of the fact that no matter how much the times and the environment had changed, they still retained the strong character of idealism they had learnt in their youth. One ideal vanished, and even though it was not immediately replaced by another one, ready-made, they would continue to search for a worthy one. They were not realists. They were not opportunists, careerists, hedonists, appeasers, nihilists, or escapists. They were representatives of that extremely difficult to describe Chinese style of idealism. Even though the People's Republic of China has been established for over 60 years, China remains a great nation of idealists. The population of China is so large that even though the percentage of idealists is small, if they were placed in some other country, their actual number would be overwhelming. Just think of all those people currently languishing in prison or under government surveillance: human rights lawyers, political dissidents, promoters of a democratic constitution, leaders of non-governmental civil organizations, promoters of independent political parties, public intellectuals, whistleblowers, and missionaries of the underground churches. No doubt all of them are hopelessly incorrigible idealists that the People's Republic of China version 2.0 can never cure. No society can afford to be without idealists, especially not contemporary China. Of course, contemporary China is fertile soil for realists, opportunists, careerists, hedonists, appeasers, nihilists, and escapists. In this age of prosperity with 90% freedom, many people are like pigs in clover. They found their golden opportunity and are living exceptionally well. In this age, if you're lucky enough to be born into a hereditary party and government aristocracy family and your roots are a deep crimson red, then all the heartier congratulations to you. In the future, you will have a tremendous competitive advantage, and many business resources will be looking to you to cooperate with them. If China has an aristocracy, you are that aristocracy. From the point of view of a Chinese Communist Party that intends to govern China forever, you are one of them, and the party trusts you. At this point, before our plot takes a dramatic turn, and before we bid farewell to our heroes, let me first build somewhat on the story of three of our characters whose roots are as deeply red as red can be: Wei Guo, Wen Lan, and Ban Chuntao. It goes without saying that they're all riding the wave of China's age of prosperity. They're big winners under the Chinese social, political, and economic model. I'm not going to spend time relating to you how they catapulted into prominence like leaping dragons and bounding tigers. I just want to tell you, I predict that these three are flourishing now and they will continue to be in the ascendant. A rich, many splendid life awaits them. Is this, perhaps, China's destiny? Let us return to Fang Chaodi and Little C. That the two of them felt like old friends the minute they met and regretted they had not met earlier was wholly to be expected. They had such a common language and so many similar life experiences. Even more importantly, for over 2 years, the two of them had been searching, as if possessed, for like-minded individuals. And finally, they could prove that my way is not a solitary one. When Old Chen introduced them, they saw at once that they were indeed like-minded. They then seriously attempted to analyze why, when everyone around them experienced an ineffable feeling of happiness and a mild form of euphoria, they always remained clear-headed and aware. Fang Chaodi said that the American Food and Drug Administration had issued a warning in 2009 that some common medicines given to treat asthma, such as Montelukast, Zafirlukast, and Xylitone, could cause depression, anxiety, insomnia, and even suicidal tendencies. Maybe the asthma medicines prescribed in China had the same side effects. Due to their drug intake, Chinese asthma sufferers were much less prone to euphoric states than others, and thus also more clear-headed and aware. Little Xi, however, said that this was pretty strange, because the antidepressant medicines she took should have had the opposite effect. These medicines stimulated the brain to secrete more monoamines like serotonin and norepinephrine, which caused people to become excited. So people like her on antidepressants should not have been able so easily to notice that other people were high. She had read a report stating that mood-altering antidepressants had already surpassed blood pressure medicines as the most commonly used prescription drugs in America. When over-the-counter drugs were also considered, antidepressants were now the number one most used drugs in America. Many Americans who were not really suffering from clinical depression, but who didn't feel good, whose spirits were low or who were unhappy in their work, resorted to some kind of antidepressant. Little C wondered if perhaps many Chinese people were also taking antidepressants on their own initiative and feeling high all day. Fang Chaodi corrected her by reminding her that no matter how prevalent antidepressants were in China, there was no way that everyone was taking them. The phenomenon they needed to explain was why almost the entire nation was experiencing a feeling of a high, while clear-headed and sober people were so few. During the entire trip from Henan to Beijing, the two of them exchanged stories of the things they'd experienced during the past 2 years. Old Chen could only listen until Fang Chaodi drove his dust-covered Cherokee into the village where Zhengdu and Miao Miao lived. When Zhengdu heard Little Xi's voice, he thought it sounded familiar. Little Xi also felt that she had seen Zhengdu before, but could not quite remember where. That night, Zhengdu and Miao Miao put up a tent in their yard and gave their bedroom to Little Xi, while Fang Chaodi put up a folding cot in his room for Old Chen to sleep on. Little Xi had already said she wanted to be with Old Chen, but she needed a little time to adjust, a hint that she didn't want to move in and live with him straight away. Fang Chaodi said Little Xi could stay in Miao Miao's room for the time being, and when the weather was a little cooler, he and Zhengdu could build on another room for her. Old Chen speculated that if, for the moment, Little Xi didn't want to move in with him, that didn't mean she wanted to live for a long time in the countryside. He didn't, however, push her to decide straight away. He thought that by staying for a while with Miao Miao and Zhengdu and having Fang Chaodi to talk to, she would avoid the prying eyes of the government, and this was not a bad idea at all. It was very difficult for an outsider like Old Chen to anticipate what sort of a powerful fighting spirit might be generated when people like Fang Chaodi and Little Xi, who had been without a comrade to share her Chinese-style idealism for such a long time, came together. Not to mention with a strong young man like Zhengdu as their ally. After a detailed discussion with Fang Chaodi and Zhengdu, Little Xi gradually began to regain her memory of the first day of that lost month. It was on the 8th day of the first lunar month, after the spring festival holiday had ended, when people started to return to work, but the television, papers and internet reports all carried the same news. The global economy had entered a new period of crisis. "We all suddenly felt we were facing imminent disaster," they recalled. A rollercoaster ride of varying accounts appeared on the internet and mobile phones. In the beginning, everybody cursed America for its runaway inflation and for the overnight 30% drop in the value of the dollar that caused the Chinese people to lose a vast amount of their hard-earned foreign exchange reserves. Then we heard that the southern factories had closed down, the peasant workers could not return to the cities to work, and the Chinese economy was really going to collapse this time. Next came the news that the price of gold had risen to $2,000 an ounce, that the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock markets had completely shut down to avoid further losses, and that martial law had already been declared in Xinjiang and Tibet. The atmosphere in Beijing changed instantly. Office workers headed for home, causing a huge traffic snarl-up, while gossip of all kinds continued to circulate. By the afternoon, the people's response was to start stocking up on food and everyday essentials. Zhengdu described how at that point, he and Miao Miao had gone out immediately to buy dog and cat food, and a good thing too, because after it ran out, there was none available for over a month. In any system, especially an economic system, if everyone's activity is duplicated and multiplied so that there is only one sort of feedback without any opposing message, that system will surely collapse, they concluded. Stocking up on food and essentials worked like that. At first, everyone was afraid of prices rocketing, so they bought everything, cleaned out the shelves and stockpiled stuff at home. When everyone did the same thing, the supply was soon insufficient to meet the demand, and then genuine panic buying set in. It was equally strange that while Beijing's official central television was broadcasting news reports of social chaos all around the world, no one came on, as they usually did, to reassure the public that supplies of food and other essentials would be sufficient to meet people's needs. Fang Chaodi said the government could not possibly have been so slow to act. He and Little Xi at the time both believed that there was something suspicious about the situation. There had to be another reason for the government's inaction. Little Xi remembered that she had phoned around all that afternoon to various intellectuals and media people she knew to see if they had any ideas about what to do or if they wanted to get together to discuss the situation. Everyone was too busy stocking up on food and other supplies for their own families, and nobody had the time to talk about formulating a response. In the late afternoon, Little Xi and Big Sister Song decided to close the restaurant and go home. On the way home, they noticed how few people and cars there were on the streets, just as after the 4th of June 1989 and during the 2003 SARS epidemic. They were carrying food back from the restaurant when someone rode by on a bicycle and grabbed a big turnip right out of Big Sister Song's hands. Rumours circulated on the internet, television and mobile networks, while police car, ambulance and fire truck sirens could be heard howling outside. But no night curfew was announced, so people in the courtyard organised their own mutual defence squad. Little Xi could still not remember the events of the second day. The effort of recalling gave her a headache and made her feel sick. She only knew that one night when she came home, she had shouted, "They're going to crack down again!" She could not sleep all night and kept mumbling it to herself. Early the next morning, she went out into the courtyard to curse the Communist Party, the government, and the neighbours, and shouted that the law courts were all bullshit. She fainted soon after, and when she woke up, she was in a mental hospital. This was what her mother told her after she was discharged, but strangely enough, after a while, even Big Sister Song could no longer remember any of it. Fang Chaodi said he was in Guangdong at the time, and the state of anarchy lasted for 7 days. For the first six, everybody was already terribly frightened because they'd heard there was great chaos in various other regions. Fang Chaodi had been in those areas, however, and they had not really been that chaotic. But he was given the third degree because he was an outsider. On the 12th of the month, he slipped away to the border area where Guangdong, Jiangxi and Hunan came together and stayed in a peasant's house. Later on, he heard that the 14th had been the worst day because a riot, with looting and arson, had broken out. Many local residents tried to escape by going to the county seat where they heard things were safer. Lots of people received the same message over and over. "I've just had this news from the highest authorities. The country is in chaos. The government has lost control. Take care of yourselves, everybody." Is China going to collapse? This was a question many had been asking for years. Will the Chinese government lose control? Fang Chaodi had travelled all over the country, in the western regions, the central plains and elsewhere, and he'd always told everyone, "Relax, there's no way for the disaffected to join forces. China will always experience small disturbances, but never complete chaos. The disturbances will be local in nature and will never spread to the whole country." During those 7 days, however, the people felt like they were in purgatory. Every day was too long, and by the seventh day, they had put up with as much as they could stand and were about to go to pieces. As you can imagine, various criminal elements were keen to do their worst, so the population felt terrorized. There was almost mass hysteria. It looked as if total anarchy would soon break out. A fight of neighbour against neighbour to protect one's life and property. People had just one hope in their minds, that the machinery of state would soon go into action. Fang Chaodi had also begun to think by then that if the situation didn't improve soon, China really would collapse into total chaos. On the eighth day of the Troubles, the 15th of the first lunar month, a small detachment of the People's Liberation Army entered the township where he was and received an enthusiastic welcome from the populace. Zhengdu said this was the way he had heard it too. On the 15th day of the first lunar month, 2 years earlier, when the People's Liberation Army entered Beijing to restore order, the people of Beijing turned out in full force on the streets to welcome them. That afternoon, the Public Security Bureau, the armed police, and the People's Liberation Army issued a joint communique that a crackdown had begun. Zhengdu didn't have a Beijing residence permit and didn't dare go out on the streets. Instead, he hid out at home for 3 weeks. Little Xi wondered whether she herself had actually gone out to welcome the People's Liberation Army troops. Then she really must have lost her marbles. Maybe it was because she heard a crackdown was coming that she lost control of herself and went berserk that afternoon. Fang Chaodi told Little Xi that once the crackdown started, any suspicious person would have been locked up. He himself was turned in by a peasant and taken to the local Public Security Bureau, where he was almost sentenced to death. Luckily for him, there had been a young female judge who stood her ground against her colleagues and insisted that they handle his case on the basis of the law and the constitution. She had saved his life. Little Xi wept profusely that night as she recalled in sorrow everything that she'd been through. The crackdown of 1983, the People's Liberation Army tanks rolling into Beijing in 1989 to suppress the students, had frightened her to death and left her with an immense feeling of frustration that called into question her life choices and her abilities. But now she felt she could sense her original vitality returning. From her online disputes with those middle-aged, angry youths, where she expressed her own opinions about the government, to defending peasants' land rights with the fellowship, through to listening to Fang Chaodi tell his story of a young female judge who argued strongly for right and justice, Little Xi felt that she was growing stronger and stronger, that she had finally found her true self again. Whose idealism is the most radical, Fang Chaodi's or Little Xi's? The answer is Little Xi's. What do we mean by radical? The original classical meaning of radical is root, from the Latin radix, to find the essential root of something. Fang Chaodi has a plain and simple sense of justice, of working on behalf of heaven's way. Added to his naturally stubborn character, his sense of justice spurs him on to search tirelessly for that missing month. Little Xi's sense of justice is more abstract, more philosophical. The socialist and internationalist education that she received as a child engraved the bright words equality, justice, friendship and mutual aid firmly on her heart. She really didn't understand the hypocrisy of the Chinese Communist Party. In college, she studied the Roman and Napoleonic law that was taught again after the Cultural Revolution ended. During the 1980s and 1990s, she was baptized in the tide of Enlightenment values such as reason, liberty, democracy, truth, and human rights. Both Romanticism and rationalism made deep impressions on her, and she adopted the idealism of a typical, contemporary, westernized Chinese intellectual. Although her idealism is not without its blind spots and intrinsic limitations, due to all of the above, we know that Little Xi is more radical, and hers is a radicalism that